It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today for Rob Ferret. Many New Year's resolutions revolve around the idea of getting healthier. And one option for making sure you're getting all the vitamins and nutrients you need is to take dietary supplements.
But how do you know if you need to take supplements, and how many should you take? There have been a lot of conflicting headlines lately about the safety and effectiveness of some of these supplements.
So we've got an expert with us to give us some of the basics. Diane Burt is a professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University. Diane, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
I want to start out with maybe defining supplements, if that's something possible to do. And some of the reading I've done with this, it seems as though supplements kind of cover the waterfront. There's supplements for practically everything out there. But in your work, how do you define a supplement?
Well, a supplement would be something that you would add to your diet, generally because, you know, you think it may help make assure that you meet nutrient requirements, or in some cases people might think they want to exceed nutrient requirements. And in addition, there are non-nutrient supplements. There are botanical supplements that people take, again, to add to their diet, things that generally aren't going to be present in foods. Examples would be echinacea, or even things like peppermint. So there's quite a variety of supplements out there. I would say, in general, people take these things without a good, sound foundation that suggests they're going to improve their health. They just think, well, they can't hurt.
And the commercials don't hurt either. You know, I mean,
well,
you see the commercials, and boy, all your problems are solved with a little pill.
Exactly. You have to realize there is a huge industry pushing the supplements. And there's government agencies that are trying to get data to find out if the supplements help, and they're small in, you know, small effort in comparison to the supplement industry, which is trying to convince consumers that they need these things.
And I want to get back to the government agency aspect of this, because I guess this is my own ignorance, but I guess I assumed that I kind of thought these were medicine and were regulated in that fashion. But as it turns out, they're regulated more as a food product. And could you explain that difference to me?
Exactly. Supplements, if you go back into the 70s and 80s, the supplement industry was much smaller in the U.S., and supplements were regulated much more cautiously. In the 90s, laws came through, one called Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, or acronym DSHEA, and that law allowed supplements to be marketed with very little data suggesting they would be efficacious. And it said that as long as a manufacturer doesn't say they will prevent, treat, or mitigate disease, they can say all kinds of things. So we have a lot of supplement marketing going on, not because the data's improved, but because the laws changed back in the 90s. And a lot of the public are not aware of that. They think, oh, you know, the FDA regulates these things, and if they say these things, they must be true. That's not the case for dietary supplements.
So does any agency regulate them?
Only if you get a body count, and by that I mean dead people.
And have there been instances of that?
Yes. Ephedra was, and you may have heard of it.
Sure, yeah.
It was largely for weight loss, and they got a large enough body count on ephedra that they were able to pull it off the market. I believe the supplement industry is still fighting the banning of ephedra. They're saying, well, gee, if people use it properly, it's not a problem. But when you have this heavy marketing, you know, people feel, well, gee, it's safe. If the government's allowing it on the market, it must be safe, and the more is the better, right? And a lot of people don't use them properly. And, of course, we don't even know what proper is either.
Well, and that's the other thing, and you alluded to that at the beginning of the interview, that a lot of people use a supplement of one kind or another without really taking building a foundation for it, without thinking about it in a more holistic sense. They've seen the marketing or they heard it from a friend or whatever it might be. Could you discuss that a little bit and how large of an issue you think that might be?
It's a huge issue. My understanding is with different population groups and different types of supplements, somewhere between, 30% and 50% of the population are using supplements. And the only time you really need to take I don't know if I have another call trying to come in on this line. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
But the only time that you really need to take supplements is if a doctor has recommended that this is something that you should take. Let's say you've had a lot of blood loss. You might need to go on a supplement that has some of the nutrients that help you rebuild that blood. Iron, some of the B complex. But you'd be under the care of a physician. A pregnant woman, obviously, there's extra demands on a woman during pregnancy, and supplements are recommended at that time. But in general, the people who are taking supplements are, it's incredible. They're the most educated, they're the most wealthy, and they're the people who need them the least.
Well, then, that provides quite the challenge, then, I would think, for somebody who is trying to regulate them, who is trying to change the way the market works. Because if you've got, say, a supplement industry that has a lot of funding behind it, if you've got a well-educated populace, you could say, well, what's wrong with that? These are smart people. They know what they're getting themselves into.
Well, that's right, and that's probably why we're not going to see significant change in the near future. I don't really foresee change. I think that the FDA has tried to modify a bit the way DSHEA was implemented, and it's not getting anywhere. So I think we're just going to have to try to better educate the population that they really, most of us don't need these. The only supplements I have taken in my lifetime are for pregnancy. When I was a young, rapidly growing child, my physician recommended iron. And I had a period of time where I had low iron in my blood, and as a young adult, and I took iron then, but only at the time that it was recommended. In the dark time of the year, like we are now, I do take vitamin D. I'm up in the age category where I apparently don't produce as much of it, and I have been taking vitamin D. But these general supplements that are marketed so heavily to us, I don't take personally.
So how do you answer the idea, though, that some people say, well, we might not need them, but really, what can it hurt? It's just extra vitamin D, or it's extra nutrients, or whatever it might be.
Well, what we're finding is in the studies where they have actually given supplements in controlled trials to people and monitored them over a long term, is that in general, that we're not seeing benefits. Particularly if the people are healthy to start with, we're not seeing benefits in them. And we are seeing evidence of some detriment. And sometimes it may be in people who have health risks, particularly if you go back to some of the beta-carotene work where they actually gave beta-carotene, hoping that it would reduce cancer rates. Well, in smokers, it actually didn't. It actually increased lung cancer rates. And there's other examples of that as well. So the idea that, well, it can't do harm, the data that we have collected suggests that's probably not true. We don't really know the optimal level of vitamins. We know, that we have recommended allowances that people should take. We have some areas where we think that if you get up higher than this, you may be reaching toxic levels. But the data on those values is not as solid as we would like. So there's a lot of uncertainty in what's optimal. So just taking something because you think that it's not going to be harmful is probably not a good idea.
So would you recommend actually talking to your physician about whether this is something you ought to be considering?
Yes, I definitely would. I suggest that people who are taking supplements consult with their physician on it, and people who are considering taking supplements also consult with their physician.
We're talking about vitamins and dietary supplements during this half hour with Diane Burt, a professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University.
And we want to hear from you. Do you take dietary supplements, and why do you take them? Do you believe that they actually do improve your health? Do you have questions or concerns? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this discussion in a second, but don't forget, if you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up at 6 this week on The Media Explores, why the partisan mudslinging over the 2012 Benghazi embassy attack will not end anytime soon. Also, a rundown of the year's biggest media errors. That's coming up tonight at 6 on The Media.
We're taking your calls now. Do you have questions about supplements? Do you take supplements? Why or why not? And do you think that they improve your health? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Diane Burt this half hour, a professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State, about supplements, the idea of nutritional supplements, and whether they are good or whether they are not so good for you. Let's go to the phones. Listeners would like to join in, and Kelly is with us. It looks like she is from Salem. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I had a question. My mom takes several different supplements pretty much at every meal. She's popping a pill for something. And she says, oh, well, I heard on Dr. Oz, this or that, and gives a lot of credit to kind of famous TV doctors. Is there any legitimacy to that? Or should I tell her, you know, hey, do some more research? You know, she'll tell me, you know, don't drink coffee. It's very bad for you because of the caffeine and everything else. And then she'll take a supplement of coffee extract at lunch for her metabolism. It just seems counterintuitive.
All right. Kelly, thanks so much for that call. And Diane Burt, you know, Kelly brings up a really interesting point because TV doctors are ubiquitous these days. And, you know, you heard what Kelly's mom is doing. She hears it from Dr. Oz or other physicians on the air. And all of a sudden, she's got a bottle of pills in front of her. How do you talk to somebody like that, particularly when it is so pervasive in the media?
Yeah, it's a real problem. This over-medication, I mean, this isn't just with supplements. Often it's, you know, people taking over-the-counter meds for, you know, over-medicating. I've heard stories of people who have, you know, a table full of pills and they run their hand over and the spirit is supposed to tell them which bottle is going to be good for them. And it's a real problem because a lot of these things probably interact in ways we don't know. As I mentioned in the earlier segment, we have really inadequate information about what's optimal. We do know a little bit about what's, you know, probably getting to be too much, and we have a growing evidence of interactions. So probably taking a mix of things that have not been studied previously is a very bad idea. Again, I would recommend that that she take all of the bottles that her mom's taking, or have her mother, if she can get her to do this, take them into her physician and say, okay, this is what I'm taking. She possibly, if she does have some health issues, is taking other pharmaceutical agents for particular health concerns, and her physician can help her find out if she might be getting some interactions that could either be blocking the value of the medicine she needs for health issues, or could be interacting in very negative ways. I really don't know how to counter the media push for supplements, both TV and, you know, we're bombarded by it. Other than, you know, just keeping on pushing on better education of the population.
Let's go to Oshkosh right now, and Doug is with us. Hi, Doug.
Hello. I'm calling because I wanted to talk about a supplement that I took. I ended up with body cramps and didn't know why. And I mean, they were, you know, in my arms if I was sawing a tree limb or whatever. I mean, I had them in my back, had them all over. And friends of mine said, well, take calcium and vitamin D, and the vitamin D will help the calcium be absorbed by your body better, and you'll get rid of the cramps. So foolishly, I did that. Ended up with blood in my urine and ended up with kidney stones, which they had to go in and painfully remove. And then by talking to my doctor, I stayed off of it. And it wasn't a very high dose, but we figured out it was my high blood pressure medication that was causing the body cramps. And by changing that, I got back to normal. So it just goes to show how fine-tuned your body is and what you don't need and what can affect you.
Doug, thanks for the call. And Diane Burt, that sounds like a cautionary tale.
That is a perfect example of the problems you can get into by self-medicating and why you need to consult your physician, particularly if you're on medicines for any type of a chronic health condition, why you should consult your physician before you take any of these over-the-counter medicines or supplements.
You know, earlier you said that we've got inadequate information, really, right now about, you know, how effective these things are and where we need to be. And could you explain that and maybe talk about whether there is research going on that will give us some better handle on all of this?
Well, there's always some research going on the supplement issues. I don't know if you heard the reports that came out in the middle of December about one of them was multivitamin supplements and cardiac.
I did not hear that.
Myocardial infarction.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was multivitamin supplements and Alzheimer's. And both of those studies suggested that or found that the supplements did not, in those groups of people, the supplements were not efficacious. I think they were in the annals of New York Academy of Medicine, maybe,
mm-hmm.
One of the major medical journals, and their recommendation was we just need to tell people to stop taking these things. So there's always research coming out. The research that's been coming out lately suggests that taking this, even something as simple as a multivitamin supplement is not helping, and people are spending billions of dollars. You know, I mean, the population is. On these supplements. So there's research coming out, but it's not saying that supplements are helping. There are isolated studies, and these are usually the ones that get pushed most when something comes out and says, hey, you know, if you have Alzheimer's, taking vitamin E, you know, might help, and there was a study not too long ago. Those will get pushed heavily so people think that the vitamin E may prevent the Alzheimer's. Well, again, it's only in people with Alzheimer's that they found any effective assistance. And again, if a person has Alzheimer's, they should be consulting with their physician as to whether or not this might help them. In general, vitamin and mineral supplements are going to be helpful if you're deficient in them. So the first thing to do is to find out, do you have low levels of this? The example of the call-in mentioned the muscle cramps. You know, had he checked with his physician, he could have had his blood levels checked, and his physician could have told him, no, the vitamin D and calcium are not going to help.
Well, Diane, we've got to go, but thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
That was Diane Burt, a professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University.
Well, as we head into the weekend, you might be one of the legions of people already counting down the hours for this Sunday season 4 premiere of Downton Abbey. Forget the Packers for just a minute. We want to know what's up with Lady Mary and her family, right, Gene?
Well, I have to tell you, there are a lot of questions about this. Downton Abbey, as you know, is the most watched drama in the history of PBS. It is a big show, and I'm not going to spoil this for anybody, but season 3 ended with quite the cliffhanger. So if you haven't caught up yet and you're getting ready for season 4, I'm not going to spoil it, but let me say this. There are lots of questions to be answered.
That's right. And let's just take a listen and remember what we've been missing all this time.
Mary's main difficulty is that her situation is unresolved. I mean, is she an heiress or isn't she?
before they or you get any ideas, I will choose my own wife.
What on earth do you mean?
Well, they're clearly going to push one of the daughters at me.
I believe there's an answer which would secure your future and give you a position. You can't be serious. Just think about it.
All right, a clip from Downton Abbey. We're looking forward to season four. What about you? Are you looking forward to season four of Downton Abbey? And why do you think it has such a hold on us? For one thing, the fashions are lovely to look at.
The fashions are lovely to look at. The scenery is lovely to look at. And it's evocative, of course, of a time that we're all curious about. And a lot of the issues, you know, they resonate today. It's got a lot of timelessness to it. So it's a great program. And maybe if the Packers end early enough, I'll watch a little bit of it.
Well, Downton diehards, happy viewing. Downton Abbey airs at 8 o'clock this Sunday night on Wisconsin Public Television and Milwaukee Public Television. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up next is the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Terrorist acts in Russia have been making headlines this week. Twin bombings in the town of Volgograd have claimed the lives of at least 30, with dozens more being injured.
The bombings come just weeks before the city of Sochi hosts the Winter Olympics, raising security concerns at a time when all eyes will be on Russia.
Helping us now to make some sense of the situation is Christopher Swift. He is an adjunct professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and an international lawyer at Foley & Lardner. Christopher, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Gene. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
I want to start out with the city of Volgograd itself. A lot of people might remember it as Stalingrad. But why are we seeing these bombings here, do you suppose?
Well, there are two reasons. The first is opportunistic, and the second is strategic. And let me answer each of those elements in reverse. Volgograd is one of the largest cities in southern Russia, and it's a major transportation hub. So if you're traveling by bus or you're traveling by train, which a lot of people in Russia do, or even if you're traveling by airplane, there's a fair chance that if you're coming from northern or central or eastern Russia and going to locations in the south like Sochi or Rostov-on-Don or some of the other cities, that you're going to go through Volgograd. And so by targeting the transportation infrastructure in Volgograd, the terrorists involved in these two bombings this past week were essentially sending a message to the Russian government in Moscow saying, you know, we can compromise you at this particular choke point. We can take advantage of all of these weaknesses you have in advance of the Olympics. Now, the opportunistic side is this is about as far north into Russian territory as the Caucasus Emirate, that's the name of the terrorist syndicate operating in the region, has been able to get in recent years. It's been since 2010 that they've, you know, the last time they had a major operation in Moscow was 2010 or 2011. Since then, they've mostly been focused on the North Caucasus region, sometimes in Krasnodar, which is another southern region, and the furthest north they've been able to get in the last couple of years has been Volgograd.
And so
those are the two reasons why this city's in the news.
And really, that opportunistic and strategic element there, they can really have an outsized impact. These two bombings, you know, there are people killed and all of that, but even so, it really does send a message, and it's almost larger than it might appear to be at first blush.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. You know, having read the Russian press and having spent, you know, the last 15 years of my life studying this particular group, including, you know, doing interviews with rebels and, you know, being out in the field in Dagestan and the Dagestan-Chechnya border, it's my impression that the first of these two bombings, a woman by the name of Oksana Aslanova, was actually trying to get on a passenger train bound from Volgograd north to Moscow. And you've got to remember that the weekend right before the New Year's holiday is the most important travel weekend for Russians and Russian families. New Year's is the biggest celebration of the year. Orthodox Christian, Christmas this year falls on the 7th of January. And that two-week period sort of starting right before the new year, that's when everybody takes vacation during the winter. So getting on a train and detonating a weapon that looks like it was made of plastic explosives that large would have been an even larger event. And there's a strong possibility here, based on my reading of the scenario, that the Russian security services may have dodged a bullet. Losing 18 people in a train station bombing is one thing, but losing scores more in a train derailment is another.
And this comes right in a month or two in advance of the Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, which are, I think, are like, that's about, what, about 400 miles away. But obviously, if this
is
a big transportation hub, the crowds, the everything, it's the potential is there. Let's put it like that. So what does this force the Russian security forces to try to do? I mean, where does this leave them in all this?
Well, there's two things going on. Up in the run-up to Sochi, the Kremlin and the Russian security services, including the MVD, the Interior Ministry, the Russian equivalent of the FBI, and the FSB, the Federal Security Services, the successor agency to the KGB, both of those agencies have created what Vladimir Putin has called the Ring of Steel around Sochi. And the idea is to, you know, basically, you know, put in magnetometers at train stations and bus stations to increase the number of checkpoints, to increase the number of individuals manning those checkpoints. They've been very keen on securing airline traffic into and out of Sochi. The problem is that, you know, that ring of steel is only as strong as its weakest link. And corruption is so endemic at the lower and middle levels of the Russian security services, more so in the police than in the FSB. But even then, it's such a concern. And the group involved here has such strong incentives to try to make something happen, or at least to attempt something, that it's hard to see how the Russian government is going to be able to secure all of the venues to the degree that they would like to. It's important to note that, you know, if you're looking at this from the perspective of the insurgent group in the region, again, it's called the Caucasus Emirate, a try and a miss is still a victory for them, because the point there is to sow fear and concern and anxiety in the population. And, you know, with terrorism, it's sort of an all or nothing game. As soon as you have an event, you have a failure. And it's hard to be, you know, it's hard to bat 1,000 in every aspect of life, especially when you've got an adversary that's as ruthless and resilient as this particular group is.
And so, refresh my memory, what is the Caucasus Emirate after in all of this?
Sure. Well, going back 20 years, in 1994, Russia and Chechnya began a war over whether Chechnya would break away from the Russian Federation and form an independent state. And for the last 350 years, the Russians and the Chechens have been fighting over whether Chechnya would be part of Russia or whether Chechnya would go back to being sort of its own self-governing region. During the space of that 20 years, between 1994 and today, they fought two formal wars, two large-scale conventional wars, and now they're fighting sort of a protracted, very radicalized insurgency. And much like what we're seeing in Syria today, what happened with the Chechen cause is it radicalized, it became more marginal, but it also internationalized, or in their case, regionalized. So what started out with a bunch of Chechens trying to create an independent Republic of Chechnya turned into an Islamist movement and then a radical Salafist movement. And as they've become more radical and more marginal politically, they've also reached out to other different groups. You've got to remember about 18 to 20% of Russia's population is comprised of indigenous Muslims. So they've been reaching out to Dagestanis, they've been reaching out to Ingush, they've been reaching out to Tartars, they've been reaching out to ethnic Slavic converts to Islam, and trying to pull these people into a movement that would create an Islamic state on Russia's southern border.
You know, the last
very different from where they started, and very troubling for Russia and for the Olympics.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last time we heard some of these stories, this history, was during the Boston Marathon bombings just about a year ago.
Right.
And people are trying desperately, I think, to draw a connection there. Do you think there is one?
No, I don't think there is one. And here's why. Look, at a very superficial level, we have people that have radicalized. And we have people that are using terrorism in order to to fulfill their political objectives or their personal objectives. But when you look at what was motivating Zhohar and Tamerlane Tsarnaev in Boston, if you look at the stuff that, you know, Zhohar had written on the inside of the sailboat when the FBI finally captured him, all of that stuff was about U.S. policy in Afghanistan and Iraq. Right, so they might have been from Chechnya and Dagestan. One side of the family is Chechen, one side of the family is Dagestani. But they'd lived there for maybe 18 months since they were 3 or 4 years old. The family actually left and came to the United States to get away from the war because, you know, their parents and their uncles didn't want anything to do with it. What we see with the Caucasus Emirate is a group that started off as a secular nationalist movement, became an Islamist movement, and then it's eventually radicalized into this nasty little, you know, Salafist jihadi movement. But their focus has always been on Russia. They've never been operational outside the region. There are some Chechens who have globalized, but we're talking about, you know, dozens of people, not hundreds or thousands of people. And the connections between the two, aside from the fact that people are from the same ethnic group, and aside from the fact that people have been blowing things up, no one's been able to tie those operational connections together. And when you look at the objectives they were fighting for, they don't align.
Well, it's a very interesting and very complicated story. Christopher, thanks for taking the time to help us out with it today.
It's my pleasure, Gene.
Christopher Swift is an adjunct professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and an international lawyer at Foley and Lardner.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Our next guest has made a career out of cooking. And as a James Beard Award-winning chef, he'll be the first to admit that cooking is hard work.
But he says it should also be fun. And in this week's Food Friday segment, we're learning how to make great food and have a good time.
John Currence is the owner of the City Grocery Restaurant Group. It's based in Oxford, Mississippi. And he is the author of the book we're going to be talking about, Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey, Recipes from My Three Favorite Food Groups and Then Some. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, guys. How are you all?
We're doing pretty well. We're a little colder than you, but aside from that, we're doing fine.
That's all relative. That's all relative.
True that. I want to start talking before we get into the recipes, because we want to spend a lot of time with that, sort of getting in the mood for cooking. And you try to make cooking in the kitchen an event. You have some wine. You've got some music. You try to make it a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember as a child, sort of the revelry that, you know, went into time in the kitchen, you know, in my family's house, in my grandparents' house. And, you know, it never seemed like a chore, you know, until cleanup time came. Of course, you know, there was always so much joy involved in, you know, being in the kitchen at my grandparents' house, you know, handling this food that had come straight out of the garden, you know, or, you know, from animals that had, you know, had just been killed or, you know, or what have you. And so, you know, it's very odd, you know, for me to think about, you know, through time warp, how we've gotten from that to, you know, a time now where, you know, cooking is drudgery. It's a chore. It's, you know, it's just sort of onerous beast that, you know, that folks address and they, you know, they try to marginalize as much as possible because it's just, you know, time consuming and work. And, you know, this is without sort of saying it out now, but, you know, the book is sort of an appeal for folks to, you know, try to find the joy in cooking again. I mean, it's just, there's so much to it that it, you know, it should be easy.
And one of the ways you get that done is in this book, you include a song for every recipe you've got there. What is it about music that makes cooking fun?
Well, I mean, I guess it may be more personal than anything else, but I mean, because music is played a, you know, a huge role in my life. You know, I tell folks that, you know, I started my life, you know, at a Beatles concert. My mother took a group of her students in 1964 to City Park Stadium in New Orleans to see the Beatles when I was I was a month away from being born, you know, and so that, you know, the Beatles was the first concert that I was at. And, you know, I've seen so many acts over the years and played in a band, for 7 years. And, it's been a huge part of my life and it just became a natural part of the kitchen. And it is a part of, of lots of kitchens. And I think it's just, you know, music can set the tone, you know, whether it be metal that, you know, sort of gets the heart rate going, or classical music that just kind of calms the situation down. You know, we listen to, you know, a little bit of everything, and, you know, whether it's at home or, you know, at work. And so, you know, I think it helps enhance the, you know, the mood of, you know, whatever the situation is.
And let's talk about food for a second here, as long as we're talking about a cookbook. You talk about your three favorite food groups: pickles, pigs, and whiskey. And, you know, pickling seems to be kind of a, I don't know if it's a forgotten art, but it does seem to be something that's making a resurgence these days. What is it about pickling that really appeals to you?
Well, I mean, I guess it starts with the fact that, you know, vinegar is perhaps my, you know, my favorite condiment. And, you know, it'd be real easy to make the case for the fact, you know, that I was just lazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it is a very, very simple process, you know, that has kind of gotten a bad rap, because when folks, you know, approach it, you know, it's all of a sudden it's, oh God, we have to have tongs and a pot for sterilizing, and jars and rings and lids, and, you know, everything about it seems, you know, very sort of clinical and, you know, and laborious, when in fact, you know, you can make pickles and stick them in the refrigerator and they'll keep forever.
And it seems like you haven't met a food that you don't want to pickle. You've even got a recipe in here for pickled Honeycrisp apples.
Right. Right. And, you know, for things like that, you know, are apples better? Is a Honeycrisp apple better pickled than it is, you know, fresh? You know, probably not. But you take something in, you know, like a Honeycrisp, and you enhance the flavor with a little bit of vinegar, turn it into something else, and it becomes an interesting addition to, you know, a salad as part of a, you know, a relish to go along with some grilled meat. You know, it just, you know, you still have the texture. You can still get the flavor of the apple, but all of a sudden you get the zing of the vinegar to go along with it. So, you know, but then there are things, you know, in there, like, you know, like the pickled okra, which are absolutely quintessential.
You also spend a lot of time in your book talking about desserts, and that really attracted us here in the northern climates right now, because we need all the calories we can get in the next couple of days. There was one in particular that caught our eye. It was this chocolate espresso jolt
cake.
The jolt cake.
Right.
That
and it sounds like you make it with jolt cola.
Yeah, I remember that. Twice the sugar and double the caffeine or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's, I referenced that in the head note. And that was, you know, that was the idea young in my career. You know, I really sort of noticed it, like when I would go to these, you know, these big meals, these multi-course meals, that like by the time you got to dessert, you know, you were just literally exhausted. And, you know, as much as I, you know, would be a 20-something-year-old and, you know, feel like I ought to want to just load up and go out and have drinks when dinner's over, all I wanted to do was go to bed. And, you know, so I wanted to come up with something that just sort of like shot the senses and the nerve endings and everything in between. You know, so there's the, you know, the caffeine and the chocolate, and then this added espresso to it. And, it's a lovely cake. It, you know, and it's a flourless chocolate cake. So it's really, you know, it's very fudgy. And, when it cools, it's very dense. It's odd, straight out of the oven. You know, it's this wonderful, like, pudding cake. But once it cools, you know, the butter hardens and the chocolate hardens, and you get this really sort of dense, fudgy thing. And it's absolutely wonderful. And it was a white chocolate mousse were the two first desserts that we ever served at City Grocery when we opened in 1992.
So I'm assuming you can still buy Jolt Cola then?
No, you can't, actually.
You can't buy it. So what do you just use Coca-Cola or something like that?
Well, there's not actually... There's none in there. The jolt is meant to be just sort of the jolt you get from the caffeine.
Gotcha.
But it worked well because of, you know, sort of in those days, you know, of the early part of my career when I was living off of Jolt Cola and no dose pills, remember those crazy caffeine pills, and that's how I got through, you know, the end of college. And when I was working 4 or 5 cooking jobs, I've like stayed awake at times.
And I should point out that we do have the recipe for that jolt cake up on the Central Time Facebook page. So if you're in the mood for something fudgy, chocolate pudding cakey, as we just heard it described, you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page and check it out for the recipe. Maybe something to do during the bitter weather coming our way. Now, we haven't talked yet about pigs, which is the third part of what you love in this cookbook here. Bacon is something that's dear to your heart. Real quickly, in our next 30 seconds or so, what do you love about bacon?
It's one of those things. It's been so omnipresent. I've been exposed to so many different varieties of it, whether it was, you know, straight off of butchered hogs that, my grandfather, you know, took in, you know, or, you know, these different, varieties of store-bought that I grew up with, or, you know, now the gazillion, varieties of boutique bacons that are out there. It's just one of those things that, there's nothing else in the world that comes close to tasting like it.
And there we go. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. John Currents, thanks so much for joining us. John Currents is a James Beard Award-winning chef, owner of the City Grocery Restaurant Group based in Oxford, Mississippi, and author of Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey, recipes from my 3 favorite food groups, and then some.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.